Have you ever looked around at a society that is technically at peace, like, no bombs falling, no open civil war in the streets, the borders are secure, and yet everything just feels like it's quietly, pervasively breaking down?
Yeah, that ambient sense of collapse.
Exactly. You look at your community or you look at the news, and hunger is just normalized. Burnout is basically, I mean, it's just an accepted death line for adults today.
Right, it's just Tuesday.
Exactly. Ecological collapse is happening in real time, and there's this crushing, just ambient loneliness everywhere. But because the guns are silent, because the military isn't actively deployed in our backyards, we just look around at all this quiet devastation and we call it peace.
It's an incredibly binary and honestly, an incredibly impoverished way of looking at the world.
Totally.
Because we operate on this base assumption that, well, that if there is an active, highly visible, kinetic warfare, like if buildings aren't physically exploding, then the default state we are existing in must be peace. And, it's comforting to think that way, right? I mean, it lets us off the hook. We really like things to be categorized neatly into just war and peace.
But then you step into the actual lived experience of, I mean, millions of people, right? You look at the stress on their bodies, the precariousness of their daily survival, and suddenly that neat categorization just completely falls apart.
It shatters.
It does. We're looking at a definition of peace that is fundamentally inadequate. I mean, we are settling for a peace that allows for immense generational suffering, so long as that suffering remains, quiet, orderly, and economically productive.
And that is exactly the diagnostic failure we are exploring today. I mean, we are living in a society that basically lacks a vocabulary to describe its own self-destruction, simply because it doesn't look like a battlefield.
So for this deep dive, we are unpacking an incredibly fascinating, incredibly dense theoretical
It
framework.
really is.
Yeah, it's a paper dated May 6, 2026, authored by Dr. Pachara Sarli, and it's titled Get Ready for This: Life Coherent Peace, an Autopoietic Life Value Anti-Violence Framework for Human and Planetary Flourishing. I know it is a massive title with a lot of syllables.
Yeah, the ambition of this text is just staggering. But it's built on a very grounded, very urgent premise. It
Right.
is basically trying to build a bridge
Yeah.
between the physical reality of human biology and the abstract reality of like global economics and peace theory.
So our mission today is to completely dismantle that conventional definition of peace, which is, essentially just non-war, and construct a new, incredibly robust framework from this paper.
Exactly.
Because this paper defines peace not as the absence of conflict, but as the organized social, ecological, and cultural enablement of life. We are going to explore how our biology, the invisible rules of our economic systems, and even the everyday language we use dictate whether we are truly flourishing or whether we are just like slowly suffocating in a room we've arbitrarily labeled peaceful.
To do that, the author synthesizes three very different, very profound bodies of thought.
Okay.
We are going to be connecting dots across peace research, formal biology, and structural economics. And it starts by tearing down the illusion of what we currently accept as success.
Right. So let's start with that foundational illusion. The text introduces us to a thinker named Johann Galtung and his concept of negative peace. What are we actually talking about here?
So negative peace is exactly what you described in the introduction. It is the mere absence of visible disorder or direct violence.
Just the quiet.
Right, just the quiet. In a state of negative peace, the streets are relatively quiet, the state maintains order, people go to work, the legal system functions. The absence of a negative is the definition.
Okay, I'm tracking.
But Galtung contrasts this with positive peace. And positive peace is the presence of conditions that actually allow human beings to fulfill their potential. It requires transforming the structural conditions, like the economic realities, the social hierarchies, the access to resources that currently prevent people from flourishing.
So we've basically built a society that is optimized entirely for negative peace, and we're acting confused about why everyone is so miserable.
We really are.
Because right now we are living in a massive, glaring contradiction, and the paper points this out brilliantly. We have societies with like extraordinary technical power and historical wealth, yet an economy can be said to be growing, the stock market can be hitting all-time highs, while the ecosystems that literally provide our oxygen and water are collapsing.
Exactly. A state can maintain perfect order while actively reproducing deprivation and poverty.
And we tolerate these contradictions because our metrics for success are just fundamentally broken.
Right. If we only measure peace by the absence of war, and we only measure economic success by, say, the growth of gross domestic product, we are flying completely blind.
Yeah, totally blind.
Well, because GDP doesn't care if $1 million was generated by building a hospital or clear-cutting an ancient forest. It just registers the transaction. Mm-hmm. We lack a coherent, life-grounded criterion to distinguish what actually enables life from what disables it.
It's wild when you think about it. I mean, measuring peace just by the absence of war is like saying a patient is perfectly healthy simply because they aren't currently having a massive fatal heart attack, while completely ignoring the fact that they are suffering from chronic wasting malnutrition.
That is a brilliant analogy. I love that. The heart attack is direct violence, right? It's the war, the sudden rupture.
Boom.
Done. Exactly. But the malnutrition is the structural violence. It's the slow, invisible deprivation that kills you just as surely, but, you know, it doesn't make the evening news.
Right.
And to address both the heart attack and the malnutrition, the author introduces what is called the triadic architecture of life-coherent peace.
The triadic architecture. Okay, this is the engine of the entire framework.
Right? It is. It unites Johann Galtung, who gives us the diagnosis of violence, Humberto Maturana, who provides the strict biological reality of how living systems function, and John McMurtry, who provides a new ethical and economic criterion for what is actually valuable.
And these three thinkers aren't just grouped together for convenience. The framework shows how they constantly illuminate one another.
Yes.
Because you can't just diagnose the violence without understanding the biology it disrupts. And, well, you can't fix the biology without a new economic value system. They create a unified grammar of what it means to be life coherent.
What's fascinating here is how they fit together so perfectly. Galtung shows us the invisible violence. Maturana explains the literal physical damage that violence causes to our cells and our minds. And McMurtry gives us the compass to navigate our way out of it by, well, redefining what we actually value.
So to understand how to build this positive peace, this life-coherent peace, we have to fundamentally redefine what the word value actually means.
We do.
And to do that, we have to basically strip away centuries of economic theory and look directly at biology. So let's dig into John McMurtry's life value criterion.
This requires a massive shift in perspective, because we have been trained to equate value with price, right? With markets, with what someone is willing to pay.
Supply and demand.
Exactly. McMurtry throws all of that out. He asks a much more fundamental question, which is, what is actually good? And his answer doesn't start with subjective human preferences or utility optimization. It starts with the absolute requirements of life itself.
Okay, lay it on me. What is the criterion?
His primary axiom is that value is whatever enables a more coherently inclusive range of thought, felt, being, and action.
Okay, wait. Thought, felt, being, and action. We need to pause and unpack those three terms because I feel like they are the bedrock of everything else we're going to talk about today.
Absolutely.
The text makes it clear that thought isn't just like the ability to do calculus or write computer code. It includes imagination, memory, reflection, the capacity to learn and conceptualize the future.
Yes. And felt being is our internal landscape. It's our sensations, our emotions, our capacity for joy, fear, grief, aesthetic appreciation, and love. I mean, it is the raw experience of being alive.
Wow. And then action is our agency. It's our physical movement, our work, our creativity, our ability to actually manifest our intentions in the physical world. So value is whatever expands those three specific capacities.
Which means disvalue is whatever reduces, disables, or destroys those capacities. It is a stunningly simple but biologically rigorous metric.
Right.
If a government policy, a corporate practice, or an economic system expands human thought, felt being in action, it has objective value. Uh-huh. If it contracts, deadens, or exhausts those capacities, it is producing disvalue regardless of how much money it generates.
So we are essentially putting the entire modern economy on trial here.
Basically, yes.
Because the text contrasts two fundamental ways of organizing a society based on this concept of value. It introduces the life sequence and the money sequence. And when I read this part, I mean, it felt like someone handed me a pair of glasses that suddenly made the whole world make terrifying sense.
It is a profound distinction. Let's look at the mechanics of it. The life sequence is a formula. It goes, life leads to means of life, which leads to more or better life.
Life to means of life to better life.
Exactly. In this sequence, life is both the starting ground and the ultimate goal. The economy is viewed merely as a provisioning system.
Right.
Its only legitimate purpose is to secure the means of life. So clean water, nutritious food, safe shelter, healthcare, education, social connection, so that our organic life capacities can expand and flourish.
But then we have the system we actually live in, which is the money sequence.
Yeah.
And the formula there is completely inverted.
Completely.
Money leads to life as a means, which leads to more money.
Right. In the money sequence, money is the beginning and the end. Life itself, meaning human labor, natural ecosystems, human attention, our time, and even human illness and suffering, becomes a mere instrument.
It's just fuel.
Exactly, fuel. It becomes a tool used to facilitate private money multiplication.
So we've essentially built a societal dashboard that's completely blind to life. We're celebrating the numbers going up on the screen, completely ignoring that the engine is literally on fire.
Yes. The paper calls this condition life blindness.
Life blindness.
In a system governed entirely by the money sequence, there is literally no internal gauge for whether living beings are actually flourishing or dying. It only counts the velocity and volume of transactions.
Well, because it just sees the math.
Think about the mechanics of the food industry, for example. To the money sequence, a locally grown vegetable that deeply nourishes a community's bodies and, say, a highly processed, addictive snack food that causes long-term metabolic disease, well, they both look like positive goods.
Because they both ring up at the cash register.
Exactly. If they sell, if they generate a profit, the system registers them both as valuable. The system cannot biologically differentiate between a product that enables life and a product that disables it.
It is entirely blind. Like, when GDP rises because a massive hurricane destroyed a city and we have to spend billions to rebuild it, or because of mass chronic sickness requiring a lifetime of expensive pharmaceuticals, or, I don't know, because we are churning out millions of artillery shells, the dashboard flashes green.
Line goes up.
Line goes up. It tells us we are winning. Meanwhile, biologically, socially, and ecologically, we are degenerating.
And this is where Dr. Sakely brings in the second major thinker, the biologist Humberto Maturana.
Okay.
Because to truly grasp the sheer scale of the damage the money sequence is doing, we have to understand what a living being actually is at a cellular level.
Mm.
Maturana and his colleague Francisco Varela coined a very specific term for this, which is autopoiesis.
Wait, auto what? Autopoiesis?
Anapoiesis. Auto meaning self. And poiesis mean creation or production.
Oh, like poetry.
Exactly. Making living beings are autopoietic unities. We are self-producing systems.
Okay, let's unpack this because that distinction feels vital. We are not machines.
No.
A car is built in a factory by external forces, right? It's static until someone turns the key. A human being, a forest, a dog. We are autonomous, self-producing unities. We continuously regenerate our own cells, maintain our own physical boundaries, and regulate our internal temperature just to exist from one second to the next.
Yes. But here is the critical part. We cannot do that self-production in a vacuum. We require what Maturana calls structural coupling.
Structural coupling. Okay, let's really dig into this concept because it is the hinge for the entire argument about violence later on. The idea is that an autopoietic system is in constant, ongoing, necessary congruence with its environment, its medium.
That's right.
Let me try to visualize this. It's like autopoiesis is the act of building and maintaining an airplane while you are flying it in midair.
I like this.
You are constantly repairing the engine, patching the wings, pumping the fuel. That's the self-production. But the structural coupling is the relationship between the plane and the air itself.
Yes.
The air provides the lift, the oxygen for the engine. If the air suddenly turns into thick volcanic ash or becomes a total vacuum, it doesn't matter how hard the plane tries to repair itself, it cannot maintain its existence. The environment dictates your ability to self-produce.
That is a phenomenal analogy.
Yeah.
Because it moves the conversation away from abstract economics and grounds it in brutal physical reality.
Right.
It highlights that the means of life McMurtry talked about, clean air, potable water, safe housing, medical care, they aren't just nice consumer preferences. They aren't just, you know, lifestyle choices. They are absolute biological imperatives.
Because without them, the plane crashes.
Exactly. If you deprive a human being of clean water or safe housing, you aren't just lowering their subjective standard of living. You are actively, physically severing the structural coupling they require to biologically maintain their autopoietic system.
You are literally breaking the air around their airplane.
Exactly. You are forcing their internal systems to work harder and harder just to survive, exhausting their capacities until the system eventually breaks down.
So if a toxic environment or a deprivation of resources physically damages our ability to self-produce, then we have to look at how our human-made institutions and economic rules inflict real biological damage without anyone ever throwing a punch.
Yes.
And this fundamentally shifts how we define harm.
Which brings us back to Johann Galtung and the taxonomy of violence. We really have to expand our diagnostic lens beyond the battlefield here.
Right.
Galtung gave us a framework that starts with direct violence.
Mm-hmm.
This is the obvious stuff. It's physical injury, bullets, physical assault, a bomb dropping. It is an immediate, localized reduction of someone's life capacity, and it is usually perpetrated by a specific, identifiable actor.
But then he introduces structural violence, and this is the concept that changes everything, right?
It is.
Because structural violence is avoidable institutional disablement. It's poverty. It's systemic racism. It's being excluded from life-saving medical care simply because you lack the purchasing power in a privatized system.
Exactly.
The violence is baked into the very rules of the society. There is no single person pulling a trigger, no single villain to arrest, but the biological harm is just as real and just as lethal.
And the third layer, which essentially protects the first two, is cultural violence.
Okay, what's that?
These are the ideological stories, the belief systems, and the meaning-making frameworks that legitimize the direct and structural violence.
Oh, like the narratives we tell ourselves.
Right. It's the narrative that says, you know, the poor are simply lazy and deserve their lot, or boom and bust market crashes are just the natural weather of the economy, or that ecological destruction is the unfortunate but necessary price of human progress. Cultural violence tells us the harm is normal, inevitable, or even righteous.
So when Dr. Savely takes Galtung's structural violence, male Tirana's biology, and McMurtry's value system and mashes them all together, we get this incredibly profound new definition. Structural violence isn't just an abstract sociological concept. It is literally damaged structural coupling.
Let's ground that in a very specific, mundane reality. Think about a child who develops chronic, debilitating asthma because heavy commercial diesel traffic is intentionally routed through their low-income neighborhood rather than the affluent suburbs.
Right, which happens all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
Conventional economic frameworks might call that an externality or maybe just, you know, unfortunate urban zoning. This framework calls it structural violence.
Because it's breaking their plane.
Exactly. Because it is avoidably damaging that child's organism-medium relationship. The toxic air is severing their structural coupling. Because they are struggling to breathe, they can't sleep. Because they can't sleep, they can't focus in school. Their range of thought, felt being, and action is physically contracting.
Or think about the modern labor market. Think about precarious labor. You have a worker juggling three gig economy jobs just to make rent. They are chronically sleep deprived, constantly stressed about the threat of eviction. Their body is physically breaking down from repetitive motion. They have no time to read, no time to connect with their family, no time to engage in their community.
It's exhausting.
It is. That economic structure is violently contracting their range of thought and felt being. It is biologically disabling them. But wait, hold on. Let me push back on this because I know exactly what the critics of this theory would say because I'm hearing this and thinking, well, if I stub my toe on a poorly designed city sidewalk, is the city committing structural violence against me?
Right, the slippery slope argument.
Exactly. If we start calling bad traffic zoning violence or gig work violence, don't we completely water down the word? If every policy we don't like is labeled violence, doesn't the concept lose all its analytical power and just become a vague synonym for bad stuff?
It's a great question. It's actually the most common and, frankly, the most important critique of Galtung's work. But the beauty of this specific framework is how it answers that challenge.
Okay.
It argues that the definition doesn't become vague at all, precisely because it is now anchored in a strict, observable biological criterion.
The autopoietic life capacity.
Exactly. It isn't violent simply because it frustrates a subjective preference or lowers a theoretical utility score or because you just find it politically distasteful. It is violence because it avoidably disables the physical and mental capacities of a living being.
Avoidable.
The key word is avoidable. A hurricane is not violence. That's a natural perturbation. But a government failing to build levees in a poor neighborhood when they absolutely had the resources to do so, that is avoidable institutional disablement.
I see.
If an economic policy intentionally blocks human potential and causes a population's physical or mental health to break down over 10 years, it is doing the exact same biological work as a slow-acting poison or a weapon. It's just operating on a longer timeline with more plausible deniability. The metric isn't subjective outrage. It is the empirical expansion or contraction of life.
Wow. Okay, so if we are surrounded by this slow motion structural violence, if our economies are systematically disabling our life capacities, how on earth do we tolerate it? Like, why aren't we rioting in the streets every day?
Right.
To understand that, we have to look at the stories we tell ourselves. We have to look at the power of the words we use. And this brings us to the concept of languaging and the civil commons.
This is a deeply philosophical but fiercely practical part of the framework. Maturana and Varela argue that human beings do not just passively mirror a pre-existing objective world in our minds. Through the act of language, what they call languaging, we actually bring forth worlds.
Bringing forth worlds. It means the words we use aren't just neutral labels we slap onto things, right? They actively shape what we are capable of perceiving and how we interact with reality.
Yes.
And the text points out how the money sequence uses language to abstract and instrumentalize life, completely hiding the violence.
What's fascinating here is how cultural violence hides in plain sight through professional jargon and, you know, bureaucratic sterile language. Think about the words we just accept as normal.
Like what?
Well, when a massive logging corporation calls an ancient forest timber reserves, it stops being a complex web of structural coupling, biodiversity, and life support, and it basically becomes a mere commodity waiting to be monetized.
Oh, wow, yeah.
When a hospital administration refers to a sick patient as a revenue stream or a bed blocker, their autopoietic reality, their pain, their humanity is entirely erased.
Just totally wiped out.
When a military drone strike kills a family of civilians and the press briefing calls it collateral damage, the language is actively participating in bringing forth a world where that horrific life disablement appears sterile, necessary, and, well, mathematically acceptable.
Human resources is the one that always gets me.
Oh, yeah.
We literally call human beings with all their complex felt being and capacity for thought resources to be extracted and managed alongside, like office supplies and capital assets. It completely sanitizes the extraction. It makes the disablement of life invisible to the people managing the spreadsheets.
It really does. It distances us from the reality of the harm.
So if language can be used so effectively for cultural violence, it also has to be the key to building life-coherent peace. We have to language a new world.
We do.
And this is where Maturana introduces his definition of love. And I have to say, reading this paper, this is definitely not the greeting card romantic comedy version of love.
No, not at all. It is entirely stripped of sentimentality. For Maturana, love is an objective biological and relational domain. He defines love as accepting the other as legitimate in coexistence.
Accepting the other as legitimate in coexistence. That is a heavy, profound sentence.
It is.
It means you recognize their absolute right to structural coupling. You recognize their right to thought, felt being, and action without requiring them to justify their existence by being profitable to you.
And this bridges perfectly from Maturana's biology to John McMurtry's macroeconomics, specifically his concept of the civil commons.
Okay, let's connect those.
Because if love is the relational acceptance of legitimacy, the civil commons is how a complex society actually institutionalizes that love at scale.
Yes. McMurtry defines the civil commons as all the shared institutions, infrastructures, laws, and practices that a society builds to secure universal access to the means of life. We are talking about public health systems, municipal water treatment plants, public libraries, neighborhood parks, universal education, labor protections, occupational health and safety laws.
Right. If we synthesize these ideas, we arrive at a beautiful definition. The civil commons is the infrastructural expression of a society organized under the relational norm that the other's life is legitimate.
Think about what a public water treatment plant actually represents.
Yeah.
A water system that provides clean water to everyone, regardless of their wealth or their employment status, is the society physically saying, your body matters. Your biological autopoiesis is legitimate and we will protect it. A public library, free and open to all, is the society saying, your capacity for thought and imagination matters.
And changing our language to reflect this reality is an act of resistance.
Well,
using McMurtry's terms, like calling public water a means of life rather than just a municipal service, or calling a public park life capital rather than undeveloped real estate, is an active attempt to restore our perception. It is the antidote to the life blindness that the money sequence causes.
But the paper also issues a very stark, very necessary warning here. Bureaucracies, even those originally designed as civil commons to protect life, are not inherently loving. They can rot from the inside. They can become cold, rigid, and deeply coercive.
This is a crucial caveat. Structure without love meaning, without that ongoing relational recognition of the citizen's legitimacy, ceases to be a commons and becomes a system of domination.
Right.
Think about a welfare office that humiliates applicants, forcing them to prove how destitute they are through endless dehumanizing paperwork.
Yeah.
That is structurally violent, even if it eventually hands out a check.
And there's a danger of what the text calls epistemic colonization. I want to dig into the mechanics of this because it's a trap I think a lot of well-meaning activists fall into.
Oh, absolutely. Epistemic colonization happens when you take this new life-coherent vocabulary and you use it as a moral weapon to bludgeon or humiliate people who are just trying to survive within the current lifeline systems.
Using the words against people.
Exactly. If you wield this theory to feel intellectually superior, you are reproducing the very cultural violence you claim to be fighting. You cannot declare the money sequence illegitimate by declaring the people caught inside it illegitimate.
Exactly. You can't scream at a stressed-out gig worker driving an Uber that they are participating in organized disvalue and destroying the biosphere when they literally just need to pay rent by Tuesday.
Right.
Doing that destroys their felt being. It's coercive. So moving beyond the philosophy, the massive question becomes, how do we actually apply this concept of institutionalized legitimacy to the real, complex, massive systems that govern our daily lives?
The paper tackles this head-on by creating a matrix of transformation.
The matrix of transformation. Okay.
It takes the life-coherent framework and applies it across five specific macro domains of daily life: health, economy, education, ecology, and governance.
Let's walk through the mechanics of how life-coherent peace fundamentally reframes each of these pillars of society. Let's start with health. We touched on this earlier with the heart attack analogy. What does a life-blind health system look like?
A life-blind health system is completely reactive and highly commodified. It basically waits for the biological machine to break down, and then it intervenes to repair it, usually for a profit. It treats the symptom in total isolation from the environment.
Just patching the plane midair without checking the air.
Exactly. A life-coherent health system, however, shifts its entire center of gravity toward conserving structural coupling before the breakdown occurs. It recognizes that clean air, safe and affordable housing, secure and meaningful work, and social belonging are not just peripheral social issues that sit outside the realm of medicine. They are the fundamental, non-negotiable conditions of biological viability.
Mm.
In this framework, health isn't just a hospital. Health is the entire functioning civil commons.
Wow. Okay, moving to the second domain, the economy. We've talked extensively about the money sequence, but how does this framework reframe a core economic concept like efficiency?
In our current life-blind economy, efficiency has a very narrow mathematical definition. It just means producing the maximum volume of commodities at the lowest possible monetary cost, period.
Right, maximizing margin.
Yes. And it achieves that efficiency by externalizing the real costs, shifting the bodily injury, the toxic pollution, the psychological stress onto vulnerable communities and ecosystems.
So it's not actually efficient, it's just offloading the inefficiency. Exactly. A life-coherent economy redefines efficiency entirely. A process is only considered efficient if it enables the maximum expansion of life capacity with the absolute minimal waste, minimal ecological damage, and minimal human domination.
So, churning out millions of cheap, disposable plastic toys in a factory powered by coal while paying the workers literal pennies is technically highly efficient under the money sequence. But under life-coherent peace, that entire operation is categorized as organized, massive disvalue. It is an inefficient catastrophe.
Spot on.
Let's look at the third domain, education. I want to talk directly to you, the listener, for a second. Think about your own educational journey or your kid's school or your college experience. Think about the debt, the standardized testing, the anxiety. Are those institutions operating on the life sequence, genuinely cultivating your capacities for thought and felt being? Or are they operating on the money sequence?
It's a tough question to ask.
It is. Is your education just a debt-financed, high-stress, zero-sum competition to acquire a credential so you can hopefully survive the labor market? That is exactly the dividing line. A life-blind system views students merely as human capital formation.
Ah, that phrase.
I know. The goal is to extract performance and mold them into compliant economic inputs. A life-coherent education system, by contrast, is designed as a civil commons of world disclosure.
World disclosure.
Yes, its sole legitimate purpose is to cultivate thought, imagination, felt being, and relational responsibility. It isn't just about job training. It's about expanding the human capacity to understand, care for, and participate meaningfully in the shared world.
The fourth domain is ecology. And this is so much deeper than just, you know, we should recycle more or let's plant some trees to offset our carbon.
Oh, much deeper.
A lifeline system sees the Earth merely as an extractive input repository on one end and a garbage dump on the other.
Whereas Life Coherent Peace recognizes the biosphere as the ultimate, overarching, non-negotiable medium of structural coupling for all autopoietic life.
The air for the airplane.
Right. You literally cannot have human flourishing. You cannot have an economy if you destroy the life ground that makes human biology possible. The ecology isn't a subset of the economy. The economy is a wholly dependent subset of the ecology.
Which brings us to the fifth and final domain, governance. A lifeline government focuses its energy on maintaining strategic geopolitical advantage, ensuring continuous GDP growth, and maintaining internal order, often through policing and surveillance. How does a life-coherent government operate?
A life-coherent government evaluates every single policy, law, and budget allocation by asking one primary question. Does this intervention expand or contract the life capacities of the affected living unities?
But the critical mechanism here, and this is where the theory gets very grounded, is that true life-coherent governance must be highly participatory.
It absolutely has to be.
Right. But I want to unpack the how here. How does participatory governance actually function without just grinding to a halt in endless town hall meetings?
It functions through subsidiarity and dialogical processes. The people whose structural coupling is directly affected by a decision must be the ones defining the problem and co-creating the solution.
So you can't just impose it?
No, because you cannot mathematically impose flourishing from the top down. If a centralized technocratic government imposes a policy, even a brilliantly designed, well-intentioned life-protective policy, without dialogue, without accepting the citizens as legitimate, capable participants in their own lives, it reproduces domination.
Wow.
It disables their capacity for action and thought, thereby failing its own life-coherent metric.
But here's the massive elephant in the room. It's one thing to say we should choose life over money. That's easy. That's a bumper sticker. But what happens when my biological need to survive directly conflicts with your biological need to survive? What happens when two totally valid, genuine life sequences violently collide? How does this framework handle a zero-sum game without just playing God?
This brings us to the most challenging part of the paper, the problem of the tragic choice.
The tragic choice.
This is where the framework proves it isn't just utopian theorizing. It doesn't pretend that if we just change our language, all human conflict will magically vanish. The paper outlines a very compelling, very difficult scenario to test the theory.
Okay, let's hear it.
Imagine a massive population of displaced people, climate refugees perhaps, who desperately need emergency shelter, food, and water. Their immediate survival absolutely invokes the life criterion. They need the means of life.
But the scenario dictates that the only available arable land to build this emergency settlement is an ancient, ecologically vital forest that also happens to be deeply sacred to an indigenous community who has lived there for centuries.
Exactly.
So preserving the forest's biodiversity, its complex water cycles, and the cultural and spiritual continuity of the indigenous people also completely invokes the life criterion. Both sides are claiming a legitimate, biologically and culturally grounded need for the means of life.
Exactly. This is not a cartoonish battle between a greedy fossil fuel corporation and a pristine forest. This is life versus life. And the paper warns heavily against the two false solutions our current society typically falls back on when faced with this.
Let's look at those false solutions. The first one is money sequence arbitration. This is the classic neoliberal approach. We hire some high-priced consultants, we assign a theoretical dollar value to the forest's ecosystem services, we compare it to the dollar value of the real estate development and the labor of the refugees, and we just pick the higher number.
And the problem with that is it converts non-substitutable life into a priced math problem.
Yeah.
You cannot substitute the cultural soul of a people or the extinction of a species with a cash payout. It's profoundly life-blind.
The second false solution is abstract moral absolutism. This is the rigid ideological approach. It's saying, we must protect the pristine ecology of the forest at all human costs, let the refugees figure it out or perish. Or conversely, human biological survival always trumps trees, so fire up the bulldozers and pave the forest.
Right.
Both of these approaches artificially impose massive, catastrophic sacrifice on one living community in the name of another.
So how do we actually navigate this without resorting to those false solutions? The paper introduces a life coherence arbitration protocol.
Okay.
And it is crucial to understand that this is not a rigid bureaucratic checklist where you tally up points. It is a dialogical method. It is a structured way of forcing a very specific kind of conversation.
Let's explore the logic of how this arbitration actually works in our forest scenario.
Right. So the first thing we do isn't looking at a budget. We identify the living unities. We have to map everyone and everything actually affected, not just the loudest political stakeholders or the people with the most money. We map the refugees, the indigenous community, the local endangered species, the broader watershed, and even future generations.
Once we see everyone, we map the capacities. We ask, how exactly will thought, felt being, action, cultural continuity, and ecological viability be enabled or disabled for each of these groups, depending on what we do?
And then we hit the critical filter, distinguishing needs from wants and means from substitutes.
This is where the hard work happens.
It is. The protocol forces the arbiters to rigorously separate a universal means of life, like the refugee's absolute need for basic bodily shelter, or the indigenous community's need for their cultural life ground, from a speculative gain or a mere preference.
Got it.
For example, the refugees need shelter. They do not need single-family homes with paved driveways that require clear-cutting. We have to strip the demands down to their biological and cultural minimums.
We also have to look for thresholds of irreversibility. What harms cannot be undone. The extinction of a keystone species in that forest is irreversible. The total cultural displacement of the indigenous tribe is irreversible. Mass starvation of the refugees is irreversible. These become hard red lines where compensation is impossible.
Which leads to the core goal of the entire process, seeking compossible options before accepting sacrificial trade-offs.
Compossible flourishing. I love that phrase.
It's beautiful.
It means aggressively, creatively looking for solutions where multiple life capacities can exist together, even if neither side gets their ideal maximized outcome.
Right. In our forest example, compossibility means absolutely refusing the binary choice of bulldoze or starve.
Yeah.
Maybe it means finding temporary high-density housing on an already degraded patch of land on the edge of the forest. Maybe it involves setting strict no-go ecological zones, using regenerative building materials, and integrating the refugees into the ecological restoration work, all planned jointly and cooperatively with the indigenous community leading the land management.
It's the total rejection of the idea that one side must be entirely sacrificed. And if some level of constraint or disruption is absolutely unavoidable, the protocol demands the use of minimum sufficient force. You use the least dominating intervention possible, you don't bring in the military to force the settlement, and you don't use armed guards to keep the starving refugees out.
And all of this requires participatory languaging. The affected people, the refugees, and the indigenous leaders must be at the table defining the problem and designing the solution. You cannot treat them as abstract data points on a spreadsheet.
And finally, because we are dealing with complex, unpredictable living systems, any solution is going to cause perturbations. So there must be a commitment to ongoing monitoring, repair, and revision. You try the compossible solution, you watch the ecological and social feedback loops, and you adjust.
Exactly.
Okay, let's take this massive macro-level theoretical protocol and ground it in a highly specific, everyday case study that the text provides. Let's look at something most of us don't think twice about until it stops working. The water coming out of our kitchen tap. The water privatization test.
This is a brilliant, highly relatable application of the entire framework. We are asked to imagine a cash-strapped municipality that is deciding whether to transfer control of its aging public water infrastructure to a private for-profit investment firm.
Which happens a lot.
It does. In conventional, life-blind economic terms, the local politicians will almost certainly justify this as a purely rational and efficient move. They'll argue it provides immediate fiscal relief to the city budget, it transfers the risk, the private firm will bring in capital to modernize the rusty pipes, and it reduces the public debt burden.
Right. Under the money sequence, the water fundamentally changes its nature. It ceases to be a commons and becomes an asset. Citizens are no longer citizens. They become customers or ratepayers.
Yes.
Access to life-giving water becomes a priced service. And if a low-income family can't pay their sharply increased bill, shutting off their water is just viewed as contractual enforcement or revenue protection. It all sounds very clean, very legal, and very rational on a spreadsheet.
But when we apply the life coherence test to this exact same scenario, a completely different, much darker reality emerges. Let's evaluate this through the domains we discussed. Start with life capacity and means of life.
Biologically, water is an absolute non-negotiable condition of autopoiesis. period. You die without it. But even before you die, if you lose access to running water in your home, your bodily health, your basic hygiene, and your ability to care for your children immediately break down.
Exactly.
You can't safely cook. You can't flush toilets. Because of the stress and illness, kids can't go to school. Adults can't go to work. The capacity for thought and action is severely, violently disabled. So treating water as a conditional commodity before treating it as a universal life necessity completely inverts the life sequence. It subordinates human biology to corporate profit.
Exactly. Then we look at the domain of the civil commons and violence. When a city privatizes its water, it systematically transfers public accountability, democratic oversight, and any generated surplus away from the community and channels it toward private shareholder extraction.
Right.
If that private company shuts off water to vulnerable families who cannot afford the newly hiked rates, that action is the literal textbook definition of structural violence. The institution is producing massive, avoidable biological harm to protect its revenue stream.
And the cultural violence kicks in right on cue. The PR firm for the water company will put out a statement implying that the families without water are just experiencing a personal fiscal failure.
Yep.
They should have budgeted better. It blames the victim, individualizes the suffering, and completely hides the violent, extractive structure that caused the crisis in the first place.
We also have to evaluate the ecological life ground and the relational domain. A profit-driven entity, with its fiduciary nature, has incentives to maximize water sales, potentially leading to over-extraction from the local watershed, while simultaneously deferring critical, unglamorous maintenance to save costs.
Wow.
Relationally, the residents of the city are no longer participating in a shared democratic system. They are reduced to isolated consumers subjected to opaque, unbreakable corporate contracts.
So the ultimate value sequence question the framework asks is, does the money system serve the water as life, or does the water serve the money? In privatization, it is almost invariably the latter. The money sequence overrides universal access.
Almost always.
Wait, let me jump in here because I can hear the counter argument forming. Anyone listening might say, hold on a minute. I know plenty of public, government-run water systems that are totally corrupt, bureaucratically slow, crumbling, and frankly, terrible for the community. Look at the tragedy in Flint, Michigan. Doesn't this framework just blindly favor big government just because it has the word public on the sign?
That is a crucial nuance, and the author of the text is explicitly clear about this trap. The Life Coherent Framework does not blindly favor state ownership in the abstract.
Okay, good.
A publicly owned, government-run water system that is structurally racist in its resource allocation, physically inaccessible to marginalized neighborhoods, ecologically negligent with its wastewater, or highly punitive with its own shutoff policies, is also severely life-disabling. It is also failing the life coherence test.
Wrong.
The state can enact structural violence just as easily as a corporation.
Right. The text emphasizes that the decisive issue isn't a simplistic ideological battle of public versus private. The question is whether the institutional design, regardless of who technically holds the deed, genuinely secures the water as a universal means of life, protects the ecological integrity of the source, and remains deeply accountable to the people whose lives depend on it.
Exactly. Now, tensions around the costs of maintaining infrastructure and the need for ecological conservation are real. It costs money to treat water. But a life-coherent system handles those tensions through mechanisms like lifeline water guarantees.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning every single household receives a baseline amount of water absolutely required for survival and hygiene, regardless of ability to pay. It uses progressive tariffs where heavy, luxury users subsidize the baseline. It relies on transparent public budgeting and community participation rather than utilizing biological deprivation as a punitive enforcement tool.
This brings up a really vital danger, which leads us to the final major concept of the paper, safeguards. Because reading through this, I kept thinking, if we use this life value framework incorrectly, if we think we know what is best for everyone's biology, it could easily become a weapon.
Well, very easily.
History is absolutely full of tyrants, dictators, and colonial powers who justified incredible domination, erasure, and cruelty in the name of human progress, national security, or even civilizational flourishing.
It is the great paradox of utopian thinking. And this is why Dr. Soakley insists on a series of rigorous safeguards to prevent what the paper calls coercive life value.
Coercive life value.
You cannot impose human flourishing through coercion. The means must match the ends.
Let's run through the logic of these safeguards because they are the brakes on the system. The first safeguard is anti-reductionism. You cannot reduce human life capacity to a single metric, a single score, or a rigid bureaucratic target. life is infinitely multidimensional. You can't just say, well, caloric intake is up 10%, therefore the society is flourishing, while ignoring that everyone is deeply depressed.
The second safeguard is participatory legitimacy. We touched on this with governance. People must actively participate in designing the policies that affect their own structural coupling. You cannot just dictate the terms of flourishing from an ivory tower or a specialized committee and expect it to be life coherent.
The third is minimum sufficient force. If an institution absolutely must use constraint to stop an act of harm, say, stopping a corporation from dumping toxins, that constraint must be strictly proportionate. It must be aimed exclusively at preventing the harm, not at producing generalized obedience or punishing the transgressor for the sake of punishment.
The fourth safeguard is ecological humility. We have to operate with the profound understanding that we do not fully comprehend the complexities of the biosphere. We cannot secure short-term human needs by irreversibly destroying the web of life that sustains us long-term.
And the final safeguard is recursive repair. This is the acknowledgement of our own fallibility. We are going to make mistakes. Policies will have unintended consequences. A life-coherent society must have the built-in capacity and willingness for ongoing correction and repair.
Synthesizing all this raises a really important point about the whole endeavor. Life-coherent peace is not a blueprint for a frictionless technocracy.
Right.
It isn't a promise of a magical state of perfect stasis where no one ever disagrees and resources are perfectly infinite. Conflict is a natural part of interacting living systems. The goal of the framework is to transform how we handle the inevitable perturbations of living together. It is a disciplined, dialogical practice of social learning.
I really love that framing. Because trying to force life to flourish through domination, well, think about it. It's like a doctor trying to cure a sick patient by violently tying them to a hospital bed, ignoring their cries, and screaming at them to get better.
Exactly.
The doctor's theoretical intention might technically be health, but the method completely destroys the patient's dignity, their agency, and their trust. It destroys their felt being. It is biologically and relationally incoherent.
Precisely. You cannot cure the malnutrition by inducing a heart attack. And that profound realization brings us to the ultimate conclusion of the paper.
We have covered a massive amount of conceptual ground today. We started by rejecting the comforting illusion of negative peace and the dangerous idea that just because there's no active war, we are somehow thriving.
We explored our autopoietic nature, the undeniable biological fact that we are self-producing living systems that require constant, healthy, structural coupling with our environment just to survive. We fundamentally redefine violence, moving beyond just bullets and bombs, to include any institutional structure or cultural languaging that avoidably contracts our capacity for thought, felt being, and action.
We looked at how the civil commons institutionalizes Maturana's concept of love, the recognition of our shared legitimacy. We walked through the incredible dialogue-driven life coherence arbitration protocol to navigate those agonizing tragic choices where genuine life needs collide, refusing the false choices of money metrics or moral absolutism.
And we ended by emphasizing that this entire framework, what the paper beautifully calls a secular covenant for life on Earth, is ultimately organized around one single, piercing primary question that we can ask of any system.
Which is, does this way of living, producing, and relating enable or disable life capacities?
That's the question.
It's a question we can and should apply to massive municipal water systems, to international trade economics, to our educational institutions, and to global ecology. But as we wrap up this deep dive into the source material, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final, highly personal thought to mull over, something that builds right on what we've discussed today, but brings it into the most intimate space possible.
What's that?
We spend this entire time talking about massive global institutions, the languaging of powerful corporations, and the structural violence of the state. But what happens when you apply the exact same life coherence test to your own mind?
Oh, wow.
Think about it. When you talk to yourself, when you engage in your own internal languaging throughout the day, are you using words and narratives that actually enable your own capacity for thought and felt being? Or are you enacting structural and cultural violence on your own autopoietic system?
That's a powerful thought.
When you make a mistake or when you are exhausted, are you calling yourself a failure or a mere resource or a burden? Are you judging your own worth strictly by the money sequence metric of how productive you were today? Before we can even hope to build a life-coherent planet or a life-coherent economy, we might first have to establish a life-coherent peace with ourselves.
That is a deeply profound application of the framework. It really does establish that the work of peace starts at the absolute base level of the individual living unity.
It does. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into Dr. Sakira Lee's incredible, challenging work. We hope this conversation gives you a powerful new lens to look at the world around you, to evaluate the economy, and to rethink the kind of peace we are all actively trying to build. Until next time, keep questioning the sequences ruling your world.